10. It was broad daylight now, and realizing that he was very hungry, Ramaran went to the concealed door and asked aloud, in Galactica, for food. There was no reply, but presently a toolman brought and served him food, and as he was finishing it, a little signal sounded outside the door. "Come in," Ramaran said in Kelshak, and Har Ori entered, then the tall Shing Abundabot, and two others whom Ramaran had never seen, yet their names were in his mind, Ken Kenyek and Kraji. They were introduced to him. Politenesses were uttered. Ramaran found that he could handle himself pretty well. The necessity of keeping Falk completely hidden and suppressed was actually a convenience, freeing him to behave spontaneously. He was aware that the mentalist Ken Kenyek was trying to mind probe, and with considerable skill and force, but that did not worry him. If his barriers had held good even under the parahypnotic hood, they certainly would not falter now. None of the Shing bespoke him. They stood about in their strange, stiff fashion as if afraid of being touched, and whispered all they said. Ramaran managed to ask some of the questions which, as Ramaran, he might be expected to ask concerning Earth, mankind, the Shing, and listened gravely to the answers. Once he tried to get into phase with young Ori, but failed. The boy had no real guard up, but perhaps he had been subjected to some mental treatment which nullified the little skill in phase catching he had learned as a child, and also was under the influence of the drug he had been habituated to. Even as Ramaran sent him the slight familiar signal of their relationship in Prechnoya, Ori began sucking on a tube of paritha. In the vivid, distracting world of semi-hallucination it provided him, his perceptions were dulled, and he received nothing.
"You have seen nothing of Earth as yet but this one room,"
the one dressed as a woman, Kraji, said to Ramaran in a harsh whisper. Ramaran was wary of them all, but Kraji roused an instinctive fear or aversion in him. There was a hint of nightmare in the bulky body under the flowing robes, the long purplish black hair, the harsh, precise whisper. "I should like to see more."
"We shall show you whatever you wish to see. The Earth is open to its honored visitor."
"I do not remember seeing Earth from the Altera when we came into orbit," Ramaran said in stiff, Werelian-accented Galactica. "Nor do I remember the attack on the ship. Can you tell me why this is so?" The question might be risky, but he was genuinely curious for the answer. It was the one blank still left in his double memory.
"You were in the condition we term Acronia,"
Ken Kenyek replied.
"You came out of light speed all at once at the barrier, since your ship had no retemporalizer. You were at that moment, and for some minutes or hours after, either unconscious or insane."
"We had not run into that problem in our short runs at light speed."
"The longer the flight, the stronger the barrier."
"It was a gallant thing," Abundabot said in his creaky whisper, and with his usual floridity. "A journey of 125 light years in a scarcely tested ship."
Ramaran accepted the compliment without correcting the number.
"Come, my lords, let us show our guest the city of Earth."
Simultaneously with Abundabot's words, Ramaran caught the passage of mind speech between Kraji and Ken Kenyek, but did not get the sense of it. He was too intent on maintaining his own guard to be able to mind hear or even to receive much empathic impression.
"The ship in which you return to Werel," Ken Kenyek said, "will of course be furnished with a retemporalizer, and you will suffer no derangement at re-entering planetary space."
Ramaran had risen, rather awkwardly. Falk was used to chairs, but Ramaran was not, and had felt most uncomfortable perched up in mid-air. But he stood still now, and after a moment asked, "The ship in which we return?" Ori looked up with blurry hopefulness. Kraji yawned, showing strong yellow teeth. Abundabot said,
When you have seen all you wish to see of Earth, and have learned all you wish to learn, we have a light-speed ship ready for you to go home to Werrel in. You, Lord Agad, and Har-Ori. We ourselves travel little. There are no more wars. We have no need to trade with other worlds. And we do not wish to bankrupt poor Earth again with the immense cost of light-speed ships, merely to assuage our curiosity. We men of Earth are an old race now. We stay home, tend our garden, and do not meddle and explore abroad. But your voyage must be completed, your mission fulfilled. The new Altera awaits you at our spaceport, and Werrel awaits your return. It is a great pity that your civilization had not rediscovered the Ansible principle, so that we could be in communication with them now. By now, of course, they may have the instantaneous transmitter, but we cannot signal them, having no coordinates.
Indeed, Remarin said politely. There was a slight, tense pause. I do not think I understand, he said.
The Ansible.
I understand what the Ansible transmitter did, though not how it did it. As you say, sir, we had not, when I left Werrel, rediscovered the principles of instantaneous transmission. But I do not understand what prevented you from attempting to signal Werrel. Dangerous ground. He was all alert now, in control. A player in the game, not a piece to be moved. And he sensed the electric tension behind the three rigid faces.
Pretramaren, Abundabot said. As Har-Ori was too young to have learned the precise distances involved, we have never had the honor of knowing exactly where Werrel is located, though of course we have a general idea. As he had learned very little Galactica, Har-Ori was unable to tell us the Galactica name for Werrel's son, which of course would be meaningful to us, who share the language with you as a heritage from the days of the League. Therefore, we have been forced to wait for your assistance before we could attempt Ansible contact with Werrel, or prepare the coordinates on the ship we have ready for you.
You do not know the name of the star Werrel circles?
That unfortunately is the case. If you care to tell us.
I cannot tell you. The Xing could not be surprised. They were too self-absorbed, too egocentric. Abundabot and Ken Kenyek registered nothing at all. Craggy said in his strange, dreary, precise whisper,
"You mean you don't know either?"
"I cannot tell you the true name of the sun," Remarin said serenely. This time he caught the flicker of mind speech, Ken Kenyek to Abundabot. "I told you so."
"I apologize, Pretramaren, for my ignorance in inquiring after a forbidden matter. Will you forgive me? We do not know your ways, and though ignorance is a poor excuse, it is all I can plead."
Abundabot was creaking on when all at once the boy Ori interrupted him, scared into wakefulness.
"Pretramaren, you will be able to set the ship's coordinates. You do remember what you knew as navigator?"
Remarin turned to him and asked quietly, "Do you want to go home, Vesprechna?"
"Yes."
"In 20 or 30 days, if it pleases these lords who offer us so great a gift, we shall return in their ship to Werrel." "I am sorry," he went on, turning back to the Xing, "that my mouth and mind are closed to your question. My silence is a mean return for your generous frankness." Had they been using mind speech, he thought, the exchange would have been a great deal less polite, for he, unlike the Xing, was unable to mind lie, and therefore probably could not have said one word of his last speech.
"No matter, Lord Agad. It is your safe return, not our questions, that is important. So long as you can program the ship and all our records and course computers are at your service when you may require them. Then the question is as good as answered."
And indeed it was, for if they wanted to know where Werrell was, they would only have to examine the course he programmed into their ship. After that, if they still distrusted him, they could re-erase his mind, explaining to Ori that the restoration of his memory had caused him finally to break down. They would then send Ori off to deliver their message to Werrell. They did still distrust him, because they knew he could detect their mind-lying. If there was any way out of the trap, he had not found it yet. They all went together through the misty halls, down the ramps and elevators, out of the palace, into daylight. Falk's element of the double mind was almost entirely repressed now, and Remaren moved and thought and spoke quite freely as Remaren. He sensed the constant sharp readiness of the Shing minds, particularly that of Ken Kenyek, waiting to penetrate the least flaw or catch the slightest slip. The very pressure kept him doubly alert. So it was as Remaren, the alien, that he looked up into the sky of late morning and saw Earth's yellow sun. He stopped, caught by sudden joy. For it was something. No matter what had gone before and what might follow after, it was something to have seen the light in one lifetime of two suns. The orange gold of Werrell's sun, the white gold of Earth's. He could hold them now side by side as a man might hold two jewels, comparing their beauty for the sake of heightening their praise. The boy was standing beside him, and Remaren murmured aloud the greeting that Kelshak babies and little children were taught to say to the sun seen at dawn or after the long storms of winter. "Welcome the star of life, the center of the year." Ori picked it up midway and spoke it with him. It was the first harmony between them, and Remaren was glad of it, for he would need Ori before this game was done. A slider was summoned, and they went about the city, Remaren asking appropriate questions, and the Shing replying as they saw fit. Abundabot described elaborately how all of Estach, towers, bridges, streets, and palaces had been built overnight 1,000 years ago on a river isle on the other side of the planet, and how from century to century, whenever they felt inclined, the lords of Earth summoned their wondrous machines and instruments to move the whole city to a new site, suiting their whim. It was a pretty tale, and Ori was too benumbed with drugs and persuasions to believe anything, while if Remaren believed or not was little matter. Abundabot evidently told lies for the mere pleasure of it. Perhaps it was the only pleasure he knew. There were elaborate descriptions also of how Earth was governed, how most of the Shing spent their lives among common men, disguised as mere natives, but working for the master plan emanating from Estach, how carefree and content most of humanity was in their knowledge that the Shing would keep the peace and bear the burdens, how arts and learning were gently encouraged and rebellious and destructive elements as gently repressed. A planet of humble people, in their humble little cottages and peaceful tribes and townlets. No warring, no killing, no crowding. The old achievements and ambitions forgotten. Almost a race of children, protected by the firm, kindly guidance and the invulnerable technological strength of the Shing caste. The story went on and on, always the same with variations, soothing and reassuring. It was no wonder the poor waif Ori believed it. Remaren would have believed most of it if he had not had Falk's memories of the forest and the plains to show the rather subtle but total falseness of it. Falk had not lived on Earth among children, but among men, brutalized, suffering, and impassioned. That day they showed Remaren all over Estach, which seemed to him who had lived among the old streets of Wagest and in the great winter houses of Caspool, a sham city, vapid and artificial, impressive only by its fantastic natural setting. Then they began to take him and Ori about the world by air car and planetary car, all-day tours under the guidance of Abundabot or Kenkenyuk, jaunts to each of Earth's continents, and even out to the desolate and long-abandoned moon. The days went on. They went on playing the play for Ori's benefit, wooing Ramaran till they got from him what they wanted to know. Though he was directly or electronically watched at every moment, visually and telepathically, he was in no way restrained. Evidently, they felt they had nothing to fear from him now. Perhaps they would let him go home with Ori, then. Perhaps they thought him harmless enough in his ignorance to be allowed to leave Earth with his readjusted mind intact. But he could buy his escape from Earth only with the information they wanted, the location of Werril. So far, he had told them nothing, and they had asked nothing more. Did it so much matter, after all, if the Xing knew where Werril was? It did. Though they might not be planning any immediate attack on this potential enemy, they might well be planning to send a robot monitor out after the new Altera with an Ansible transmitter aboard to make instantaneous report to them of any preparation for interstellar flight on Werril. The Ansible would give them a 140-year start on the Werrellians. They could stop an expedition to Terra before it started. The one advantage that Werril possessed, tactically, over the Xing, was the fact that the Xing did not know where it was and might have to spend several centuries looking for it. Ramaran could buy a chance of escape only at the price of certain peril for the world to which he was responsible. So he played for time, trying to devise a way out of his dilemma, flying with Ori and one or another of the Xing here and there over the Earth, which stretched out under their flight like a great lovely garden gone all to weeds and wilderness. He sought with all his trained intelligence some way in which he could turn his situation about and become the controller instead of the one controlled, for so his Kelshak mentality presented his case to him. Seen rightly, any situation, even a chaos or a trap, would come clear and lead of itself to its one proper outcome. For there is, in the long run, no disharmony, only misunderstanding, no chance or mischance, but only the ignorant eye. So Ramaran thought, and the second soul within him, Falk, took no issue with this view, but spent no time trying to think it all out, either, for Falk had seen the dull and bright stones slip across the wires of the patterning frame, and had lived with men in their fallen estate, kings in exile on their own domain, the Earth. And to him it seemed that no man could make his fate or control the game, but only wait for the bright jewel luck to slip by on the wire of time. Harmony exists, but there is no understanding it. The way cannot be gone. So while Ramaran racked his mind, Falk lay low and waited, and when the chance came, he caught it. Or rather, as it turned out, he was caught by it. There was nothing special about the moment. They were with Kenkenyuk in a fleet little autopilot air car, one of the beautiful, clever machines that allowed the Xing to control and police the world so effectively. They were returning toward Es-Tach from a long flight out over the islands of the Western Ocean, on one of which they had made a stop of several hours at a human settlement. The natives of the island chain they had visited were handsome, contented people, entirely absorbed in sailing, swimming, and sex, afloat in the azure amniotic sea. Perfect specimens of human happiness and backwardness to show the Werrellians. Nothing to worry about there, nothing to fear. Ori was dozing, with a Paritha tube between his fingers. Kenkenyuk had put the ship on automatic, and with Ramaran, 3 or 4 feet away from him, as always, for the Xing never got physically close to anyone, was looking out the glass side of the air car at the 500-mile circle of fair weather and blue sea that surrounded them. Ramaran was tired, and let himself relax a little in this pleasant moment of suspension, aloft in a glass bubble in the center of the great blue and golden sphere.
"It is a lovely world," the Shing said.
"It is."
"The jewel of all worlds. Is Werel as beautiful?"
"No, it is harsher."
"Yes, the long year would make it so. How long? 60 earth years?"
"Yes."
"You were born in the fall, you said. That would mean you had never seen your world in summer when you left it."
"Once when I flew to the southern hemisphere, but their summers are cooler, as their winters are warmer than in Kelshi. I have not seen the great summer of the north."
"You may yet. If you return within a few months, what will the season be on Werel?"
Ramaran computed for a couple of seconds and replied, "Late summer, about the 20th moon phase of summer, perhaps."
"I made it to be fall. How long does the journey take?"
142 earth years," Ramaran said, and as he said it, a little gust of panic blew across his mind and died away. He sensed the presence of the Shing's mind in his own. While talking, Ken Kenyek had reached out mentally, found his defenses down, and taken whole phase control of his mind. That was all right. It showed incredible patience and telepathic skill on the Shing's part. He had been afraid of it, but now that it had happened, it was perfectly all right. Ken Kenyek was bespeaking him now, not in that creaky oral whisper of the Shing, but in clear, comfortable mind speech. "Now, that's all right. That's right. That's good. Isn't it pleasant that we're attuned at last?"
"Very pleasant," Ramaran agreed.
"Yes, indeed. Now we can remain attuned, and all our worries are over. Well then, 142 light-years distant, that means that your son must be the one in the Dragon Constellation. What is its name in Galactica?" "No, that's right, you can't say it or bespeak it here. Eltanin, is that it? The name of your son?" Ramaran made no response of any kind.
"Eltanin! The Dragon's Eye. Yes, that's very nice. The others we had picked as possibilities are somewhat closer in. Now this saves a great deal of time. We had almost..." The quick, clear, mocking, soothing mind speech stopped abruptly, and Ken Kenyek gave a convulsive start. So did Ramaran at the identical moment. The Shing turned jerkily toward the controls of the air car, then away. He leaned over in a strange fashion, too far over, like a puppet on strings carelessly managed. Then all at once slid to the floor of the car and lay there with his white, handsome face upturned, rigid. Ori, shaken from his euphoric drowse, was staring.
"What's wrong? What happened?"
He got no answer. Ramaran was standing as rigidly as the Shing lay, and his eyes were locked with the Shing's in a double unseeing stare. When at last he moved, he spoke in a language Ori did not know. Then laboriously he spoke in Galactica. "Put the ship in hover," he said. The boy gaped.
"What's wrong with Lord Ken, Pretch Ramaran?"
"Get up. Put the ship in hover." He was speaking Galactica now, not with his Werelian accent, but in the debased form used by Earth natives. But though the language was wrong, the urgency and authority were powerful. Ori obeyed him. The little glass bubble hung motionless in the center of the bowl of ocean eastward of the sun.
"Prechna, is the..."
"Be still." Silence. Ken Kenyek lay still. Very gradually, Ramaran's visible tension and intensity relaxed. What had happened on the mental plane between him and Ken Kenyek was a matter of ambush and re-ambush. In physical terms, the Shing had jumped Ramaran, thinking he was capturing one man, and had in turn been surprised by a second man, the mind in ambush, Falk. Only for a second had Falk been able to take control, and only by sheer force of surprise, but that had been long enough to free Ramaran from the Shing's phase control. The instant he was free, while Ken Kenyek's mind was still in phase with his and vulnerable, Ramaran had taken control. It took all his skill and all his strength to keep Ken Kenyek's mind phased with his, helpless and assenting, as his own had been a moment before. But his advantage still remained. He was still double-minded, and while Ramaran held the Shing helpless, Falk was free to think and act. This was the chance, the moment. There would be no other. Falk asked aloud, "Where is there a light-speed ship ready for flight?" It was curious to hear the Shing answer in his whispering voice, and know, for once to know certainly and absolutely, that he was not lying.
"In the desert northwest of Estach."
"Is it guarded?"
"Yes."
"By live guards?"
"No."
"You will guide us there."
"I will guide you there."
"Take the car where he tells you, Ori."
"I don't understand, Pretch Ramaran. Are we—"
"We are going to leave Earth. Now, take the controls."
"Take the controls,"
Ken Kenyek repeated softly. Ori obeyed, following the Shing's instructions as to course. At full speed, the air car shot eastward, yet seemed still to hang in the changeless center of the sea sphere, towards the circumference of which the sun behind them dropped visibly. Then the Western Isles appeared, seeming to float towards them over the wrinkled, glittering curve of the sea. Then behind these, the sharp white peaks of the coast appeared, and approached, and ran by beneath the air car. Now they were over the dun desert, broken by arid, fluted ranges casting long shadows to the east. Still following Ken Kenyek's murmured instructions, Ori slowed the ship, circled one of these ranges, set the controls to catch the landing beacon, and let the car be homed in. The high, lifeless mountains rose up about them, walling them in as the air car settled down on a pale, shadowy plain. No spaceport or airfield was visible, no roads, no buildings, but certain vague, very large shapes trembled mirage-like over the sand and sagebrush under the dark slopes of the mountains. Falk stared at them and could not focus his eyes on them, and it was Ori who said with a catch of his breath,
"Starships."
They were the interstellar ships of the Shing, their fleet, or part of it, camouflaged with light dispeller nets. Those Falk had first seen were smaller ones. There were others, which he had taken for foothills. The air car had intangibly settled itself down beside a tiny, ruined, roofless shack, its boards bleached and split by the desert wind. "What is that shack?"
"The entrance to the underground rooms is to one side of it."
"Are there ground computers down there?"
"Yes."
"Are any of the small ships ready to go?"
"They are all ready to go. They are mostly robot-controlled defense ships."
"Is there one with pilot control?"
"Yes, the one intended for Har Ori."
Ramaran kept close telepathic hold on the Shing's mind while Falk ordered him to take them to the ship and show them the onboard computers. Ken Kenyek at once obeyed. Falk Ramaran had not entirely expected him to. There were limits to mind control, just as there were to normal hypnotic suggestion. The drive to self-preservation often resisted even the strongest control, and sometimes shattered the whole attunement when infringed upon. But the treason he was being forced to commit apparently aroused no instinctive resistance in Ken Kenyek. He took them into the starship and replied obediently to all Falk Ramaran's questions, then led them back to the decrepit hut and at command unlocked, with physical and mental signals, the trap door in the sand near the door. They entered the tunnel that was revealed. At each of the underground doors and defenses and shields, Ken Kenyek gave the proper signal or response,
and so brought them at last to attack-proof, cataclysm-proof, thief-proof rooms far underground where the automatic control guides and the course computers were. Over an hour had now passed since the moment in the air car. Ken Kenyek, assenting and submissive, reminding Falk at moments of poor Estrell, stood harmlessly by, harmless so long as Remarin kept total control over his brain. The instant that control was relaxed, Ken Kenyek would send a mind call to S-Touch if he had the power, or trip some alarm, and the other Shing and their tool men would be here within a couple of minutes. But Remarin must relax that control, for he needed his mind to think with. Falk did not know how to program a computer for the light-speed course to Werrel, satellite of the sun, Eltanin. Only Remarin could do that. Falk had his own resources, however. "Give me your gun." Ken Kenyek at once handed over a little weapon kept concealed under his elaborate robes. At this, Ori stared in horror. Falk did not try to allay the boy's shock. In fact, he rubbed it in. "Reverence for life?" he inquired coldly, examining the weapon. Actually, as he had expected, it was not a gun or laser, but a low-level stunner without kill capacity. He turned it on Ken Kenyek, pitiful in his utter lack of resistance, and fired. At that, Ori screamed and lunged forward, and Falk turned the stunner on him. Then he turned away from the two sprawled, paralyzed figures, his hands shaking, and let Remarin take over as he pleased. He had done his share for the time being. Remarin had no time to spend on compunction or anxiety. He went straight to the computers and set to work. He already knew from his examination of the onboard controls that the mathematics involved in some of the ship's operations was not the familiar Cetian-based mathematics which Terrans still used and from which Werrel's mathematics via the colony also derived. Some of the processes the Shing used and built into their computers were entirely alien to Cetian mathematical process and logic, and nothing else could have so firmly persuaded Remarin that the Shing were, indeed, alien to Earth, alien to all the old League worlds, conquerors from some very distant world. He had never been quite sure that Earth's old histories and tales were correct on that point, but now he was convinced. He was, after all, essentially a mathematician. It was just as well that he was, or certain of those processes would have stopped him cold in his effort to set up the coordinates for Werrel on the Shing computers. As it was, the job took him 5 hours. All this time he had to keep, literally, half his mind on Ken Kenyek and Ori. It was simpler to keep Ori unconscious than to explain to him or order him about. It was absolutely vital that Ken Kenyek stay completely unconscious. Fortunately, the stunner was an effective little device, and once he discovered the proper setting, Falk only had to use it once more. Then he was free to coexist, as it were, while Remarin plugged away at his computations. Falk looked at nothing while Remarin worked, but listened for any noise, and was conscious always of the two motionless, senseless figures sprawled out nearby. And he thought. He thought about Estrell, wondering where she was now and what she was now. Had they retrained her, raised her mind, killed her? No, they did not kill. They were afraid to kill and afraid to die and called their fear reverence for life. The Shing, the enemy, the liars. Did they in truth lie? Perhaps that was not quite the way of it. Perhaps the essence of their lying was a profound, irremediable lack of understanding. They could not get into touch with men. They had used that and profited by it, making it into a great weapon, the mind lie. But had it been worth their while, after all? 12 centuries of lying. Ever since they had first come here, exiles or pirates or empire builders from some distant star, determined to rule over these races whose minds made no sense to them and whose flesh was to them forever sterile. Alone, isolated, deaf-mutes ruling deaf-mutes in a world of delusions. Oh, desolation. Romarin was done. After his 5 hours of driving labor and 8 seconds of work for the computer, the little iridium output slip was in his hand, ready to program into the ship's course control. He turned and stared foggily at Ori and Ken Kenyek. What to do with them? They had to come along, evidently. Erase the records on the computers, said a voice inside his mind. A familiar voice, his own, Falk's. Romarin was dizzy with fatigue, but gradually he saw the point of this request and obeyed. Then he could not think what to do next. And so, finally, for the first time, he gave up, made no effort to dominate, let himself fuse into himself. Falk Romarin got to work at once. He dragged Ken Kenyek laboriously up to ground level and across the starlit sand to the ship that trembled half-visible, opalescent in the desert night. He loaded the inert body into a contour seat, gave it an extra dose of the stunner, and then came back for Ori. Ori began to revive partway and managed to climb feebly into the ship himself.
"Brett Romarin," he said hoarsely, clutching at Falk Romarin's arm. "Where are we going?"
"To Werril."
"He's coming too? Ken Kenyek?"
"Yes. He can tell Werril his tale about Earth, and you can tell yours, and I mine. There's always more than one way towards the truth. Strap yourself in. That's it." Falk Romarin fed the little metal strip into the course controller. It was accepted, and he set the ship to act within 3 minutes. With a last glance at the desert and the stars, he shut the ports and came, hurriedly, shaky with fatigue and strain, to strap himself in beside Ori and the Shing. Liftoff was fusion-powered. The light-speed drive would go into effect only at the outer edge of Earth space. They took off very softly, and were out of the atmosphere in a few seconds. The visual screens opened automatically, and Falk Romarin saw the Earth falling away, a great, dusky, bluish curve, bright-rimmed. Then the ship came out into the unending sunlight. Was he leaving home or going home? On the screen, dawn coming over the eastern ocean shone in a golden crescent for a moment against the dust of stars, like a jewel on a great patterning frame. Then frame and pattern shattered. The barrier was passed, and the little ship broke free of time and took them out across the darkness. This concludes the reading of City of Illusions by Ursula K. Le Guin. Copyright 1967 by Ursula K. Le Guin. This book was read by Stefan Rudnicki. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Skyboat Road Company, Inc. and was produced in 2007 by Skyboat Road Company, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Skyboat Road Company, Inc. or Blackstone Audio, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.